Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Ezra Rashko, who is Associate Professor of History at Montclair State University. We'll be speaking about a fascinating new OUP book called The Nature of Endangerment in India, Tigers, Tribes, Extermination and Conservation, 1818 to 2020. Ezra, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Raj. Thanks, Dr. Balkaran. It's really wonderful to be here. And, I've really appreciated this series by the New Books Network and your work in particular. It's a great service, a great archive that you're creating, all these new books.
Thank you. Ezra, unlike the vast majority of my podcast guests, this is not our first rodeo by any stretch of the imagination. We haven't been in touch in years, but... why don't you share a little bit about how we met, how we know each other?
Yeah, that's true. Apparently it was 2009. Just refresh my memory about that.
If you can believe it, I think 2008, 2009, that sounds right. For sure it was in my master's year, so one of those years.
Yeah, it was just as I was finishing grad school in London, and I think I had worked as some sort of teaching fellow at that point already, but then got my first job as a full-time lecturer at the University of Virginia the following fall. So it's pretty easy for me to place that right there chronologically in my career. And in the intermezzo, I spent some of the summer doing field work amongst the communities that I work in, and also then spent part of that summer with this Jain Studies program, a religious studies program, where we traveled all over northern India and central India, really visiting pretty incredible Jain sites, statues of Mahavir, etc., at the forts in Gwalior and elsewhere around Madhya Pradesh.
It was a rich experience. Actually, come to think of, I should probably have someone from the IJHS on the podcast. Rich experience, lots of exposure to then academics in the field. We even had S. Janey guest lectured with us, among others, and access to practitioners, Jain ascetics. And of course, you know, just a group of people that, you know, you kind of meet and click, and then all these adventures in between all the training. It was great. It was good times, actually.
It was a really intense time, and we got to know each other really well. Yeah,
we did. And it was, you know, I was a lowly master student. So thank you for indulging me, lecture rascal at the time.
But then you went on to do some pretty great things so far, and I'm expecting more as well. It's incredible.
Well, try not to disappoint you. Tell me something. What's the backstory to this book? How did you become interested in this topic? You know.
Well, I guess
niche.
There's different ways I could tell this story. You know, like any good narrative. Like any good history, there are different versions of it.
And you wonder why we got along so well.
Yeah. One might be going back to that summer. We all had to write a sort of end paper for our Jane Studies program, ISJS program. And I wrote mine on Jane endangerment discourse, which I was actually then encouraged to publish by some of the leaders of the program. And that went into EPW. A few years later, I think, I finally actually went around and just published pretty much the exact paper that I'd written that summer, where I really looked at this discourse of the way that minority communities in general, but the Jain community in particular, with this religious minority of just a few million people in India, express their concern about minority status by speaking of their vanishment, their disappearance, their endangerment as, modernity sweeps away tradition and people stop, traditional practices that have been, passed on from generation to generation. And also even looked at the way that the school framed the rhetoric of endangerment and its own urgency in protecting Jain heritage, culture, and religion. But that's just one version. I mean, another was that back in my grad school days, I started writing a history of hunting and conservation from below, amongst Bhil and Gond, Adivasi communities in Western and Central India. And at that point, I was reading a lot of colonial texts, reading the colonial archive, a lot of big game hunting books. And I found that these colonial big game hunters were often describing the local communities that they worked with, these Bhil and Gond Adivasi, who we now call Adivasi communities. Of course, the term Adivasi hadn't been invented yet in the 19th century, but that's another issue. And they basically weren't very concerned at all about endangered species, right? They were hunting big game like carnivores, like tigers. They weren't just hunting them. They were seeking to eradicate them as vermin species, as dangerous beasts, wild beasts that were, preying upon poor people in the countryside, et cetera. But instead they were actually talking about these tribal communities as disappearing, as vanishing, as threatened with extinction. And I was I began my PhD anyway, working with David Arnold, who was, a founding member of the Subaltern Studies Collective. And so I was really interested in the way that, marginalized communities frame their own experience and their own agency, and whether you could extract that from the colonial archive or not, is still a question in my mind. But I really wanted to hear what these people themselves had to say about their experience, about these deep sort of existential questions about their survival, et cetera. And, most of my sources were also in English. So this was a great chance to go to India, to work in the field, to use my language skills, my Hindi, and I've picked up a little bit of some local dialects in Madhya Pradesh by now. But mostly to really understand my subject, it took a long time, a lot of field work, and my thoughts on the issue have really developed over the years as well.
Tell us a little bit more about the field work in terms of what does that look like? What sorts of conversations and settings and access? What was that process like for you?
Yeah, okay. Getting my feet on the ground initially back in the mid-2000s when I started this kind of oral history field work was always a little bit tough. You show up in a new place, you're trying to make some connections on the ground. But I got really lucky in Pachmari, which is was a colonial hill station in Madhya Pradesh, highest point in Madhya Pradesh in the Satpuras is up there. And I met some great people when I was just hiking around in the forest, checking out this area. There was, I don't name any of my informants, and in the book it's easier because I'll just insert a letter instead of their name. But I'm gonna try to keep this nameless here. This gentleman was out hiking with his two dogs, and one of them accidentally, I guess, caught and killed a baby wild boar, jungly sewer. And then, as I sat there sort of talking to him about that, and he was asking me, what am I doing walking around in the forest by myself? I'm like, oh, I'm just trying to figure out how to go over to those villages over there. He's like, oh, I know all the paths around here. I mean, he didn't get there exactly. Eventually, he got there. But then some other people that he knew came by, and they were actually carrying Moa liquor up to Pachmari to sell in the town, in the bazaar. Illegally, of course. They're carrying it on their backs, these heavy jugs up this steep mountain path, and all they're wearing is flip-flops. And so then we all sit down and have a drink and people just start talking and telling you things. And eventually you go and visit them and hear about how their village is being kicked out of the forest because the forest department, even though Pachmari is now being declared a biosphere reserve, which is supposed to integrate cultural and biological diversity, they're being evicted from the forest. Their forest villages are being cleared out. And so you start to wonder, I mean, the obvious thing to think is, oh my God, they're losing everything. They're losing their culture, their way of life, their forest homes. And that's sort of the initial premise, I have to admit, that I entered in around 2005 into the field with. Because I'd been exposed mainly to this kind of activist rhetoric from groups like Survival International that say, we have to save the tribal peoples of India, and that they're the best conservationists, and that their cultures will be lost without their forests. And so, I was quite surprised, especially in Pachmari, less so in other places, but especially in Pachmari, eventually to hear that a lot of people actually wanted to move out of the forest, that they were sick of living there for various reasons. That added a layer of complexity to this story that, has taken me a long time to grapple with.
What would you say? Actually, let me ask a question. What's an Adivasi?
Yeah. Okay. So I'm not really interested myself in defining these communities. I feel there's been a long history of colonial anthropology and white guys trying to define who other communities are and what they are. But I am interested in the history of discourses, right? And I can tell you all about the history of the creation of the term Adivasi and how that was from the get-go a pretty political category and has evolved over time to take on different connotations and meanings. And so, like I said earlier, in the 19th century, this term just didn't exist, right? It was really coined in the early to mid 20th century during India's independence struggle. And the first groups you really see using that term come out of what's now like Jharkhand, and there's the Adivasi Mahasabha of the 1930s. I think mistakenly Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, even attributed this term to Gurria. No, excuse me, no, that's not correct. But he attributed it to Thakur, Thakur Baba, and A.V. Thakur. But it wasn't Thakur who came up with the term. But it was started to get circulated in that period. And Gandhi himself had all sorts of different terms that he liked to use, tried to popularize for these communities, Girijans, et cetera. And, you know, at this time, a whole bunch of different terms started to arise. But Adivasis stuck, I think, because it was a very practical way of describing this status that people saw for themselves as Adi being like the first or original, and Vasis, dwellers or inhabitants or citizens of the land, right? And it's pretty equivalent to the term indigenous, autochthonous.
First Nation,
absolutely. But this has also then therefore become a pretty disputed category or way of describing these peoples, because you know, there's a lot of people on the Hindu right in particular who don't like the idea that anybody else is more indigenous to India than they are, right? Hindus have had a culture going back 3,000 or so, you know, however many years, if you count the Indus Valley civilization, more. And so the government of India hasn't embraced this term. And in fact, they've rejected a whole bunch of international conventions on the rights of indigenous peoples because they don't recognize any group as more indigenous than they, the Hindus, the mainstream, are. So on the Hindu right, one term that's preferred is Vanvasi, and that literally means, could be said to mean forest dweller. There's been this whole long discourse on what you could call the Hindu right, though they didn't necessarily call themselves in the early to mid 20th century, these are just backwards Hindus who have lost their way in the forest and need to be reincorporated into the mainstream and need to be assimilated essentially or integrated into you know, the nation and its economy and its politics.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. nbn50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you for addressing that question. And I really appreciate the reframe of, you know, you're providing knowledge on the historicity of terminology versus essentializing any peoples. And
right.
So one of the ironic things about the last point you made about the backwards forest dwellers is that one of my great fascinations, as you probably well know, I study the epics and the Puranas. Mm-hmm. One of my great fascinations is, at least in the literary imagination, the forest is a locus of higher ed for exiled kings, where they go and they become refined and they become dharmic, and they, you know, it's fascinating the ways in which the forest setting can be conceived of and presented.
Can I just say, you know, so the book is really a history of these sorts of discourses about these communities and the way that the communities have been framed, rather than trying to, me again, define them myself. And, you know, going back to the Ramayana, et cetera, they were often called Rakshasas, at least according to people like Ramala Thapur. I tried to ask Ramala, I met her once in New York City, and we were, after she gave a talk, we were at a meal together. And I said, so how do you know from the Ramayana that the Adi, you know, that who we call Adivasis today, or who we called Rakshasas in the past? And I didn't get a very clear answer. She said, oh, you know, because they had beady eyes and claws. And I was like, but that doesn't really prove that, you know. But this whole idea of, you know, going back to the myth or controversy over the Aryan invasion theory, that it was like main, you know, for thousands of years since the origins of Vedic civilization, that pushed people that we now call Adivasis into the forests and into the hills and drove them out of the plains, and that then they were demonized literally in, you know, these texts as, again, Rakshasas, et cetera. That's not really what I get into in the book. I don't read the relevant ancient languages, et cetera. But I think it is important noting that kind of starting place and those kinds of controversies about, you know, the history of tribal identity as well.
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of fascinating themes there. You know, what are we taking as an historical question or historical data versus what are we taking as a literary or narrative? Or, you know, do we leave anything to the mythic imagination? Do we assume that every element of religious thought or literature is rooted in a reality? Is there nothing to be said about the inner life traumatized through narratives, et cetera, et cetera? But less about these intrigues and more about your book.
You can talk more about that.
I was going to say, more about your book. Yeah. What would you say is the central aim, gist, argument of the book?
Okay. So there are a couple, I would say, maybe two main ones I could focus on. First of all, just starting more generally with the concept, or literally the nature of endangerment, as in the title, that the term endangerment is kind of a loaded term, right? It has all sorts of implications, complex implications, controversial implications, especially for when it comes to naming or defining or describing the experiences of indigenous peoples, Adivasis, tribal peoples, as they're variously called in the Indian context. And so I sort of start with the premise that the term endangered is just an adjective and can be applied to literally just about anything, right? Silly things like the latest flavor of candy bar that has gone, you know, under and isn't being produced anymore can be called endangered, threatened with extinction or something. More controversially, like in India, Hindu nationalists might sometimes describe, you know, the status of Hindus as endangered by, you know, various minority communities or something. And so, sometimes things that are being described as endangered are not really endangered at all. And sometimes they really are. So I'm not trying to say, you know, I think everybody wants to reduce this to, so are Adivasis endangered or are they not? But it's not that simple. I'm not trying, you know, if anything, the goal is to
It's a discourse of endangerment that I feel your interest is.
Right. And I'm trying to replace simple narratives with more complex ones and try to provide a more nuanced picture of this. But, you know, there are real problems with referring to Indigenous peoples as endangered. So these are the same communities that have historically often, really suffered from racist, dehumanizing analogies, right? Comparisons to dangerous wild beasts in the colonial imaginary. And now they're being compared very often and quite literally in a lot of activist discourse to endangered forms of wildlife that need to be protected and need to be saved. And so calling a community that has been like, you know, struggling for rights and for recognition endangered has all these implications, because when people hear the term endangered these days, especially, or the term endangerment, they mostly think of endangered species, right? And so so that's sort of one starting point. The other main issue that I have, or that I'm dealing with, though, is that actually, if you look at the history of who and what was being described as endangered, as anthropocentric as Europeans, you know, definitely were through most of the modern era, they were definitely describing people as being threatened with extinction, vanishing, disappearance, and threatened with endangerment. Threatened with extinction more, centuries before really they ever talked about environmental endangerment or wildlife endangerment. And so you can go back all the way to the origins of the colonial encounter, really, go back to just after Christopher Columbus supposedly discovered the New World, and see people like Bartolomé de las Casas, who was described as the first protector of Indians in Hispaniola in 1516, who there's a long historiographical tradition about, which talks about how he was trying to save the tribes from extinction. You know, in the 1700s, Voltaire talked about how Bartolomé de las Casas was trying to save Hispaniola's tribes from extinction. And that's, again, you know, centuries before there was any recognition that extinction even existed amongst, non-human species. And that was the discovery, scientific discovery of extinction of non-human species is something that I discussed in the book a little bit. It really begins at the beginning of the 19th century. There's all sorts of famous figures in that. I'm not writing the history of, you know, evolutionary biology here, but the concern for vanishing or disappearing non-human species really only picks up, following the age of Darwin, and then in the 20th century. Before that time, as I just said, tigers and other carnivores were certainly not seen as endangered in India. They were seen as endangering the lives of humans. They were seen as vermin, dangerous wild beasts to be eradicated. And so then a big part of that argument as well is that this language of endangerment that starts first and is really prolific in describing tribal communities, endangered tribal peoples, primitive races, as the colonists called them, vanishing races, then gets actually mapped on to the language of endangered species and environmentalism. And so there's a shift from this anthropocentric perspective to a more biocentric one that comes, later in the Anthropocene.
Could you say a bit regarding this question of survival, if you will, say a bit about how Adivasis themselves, at least in your experience, in your fieldwork, would qualify, characterize, think about, discuss this issue in their own terms?
Right. So I've mostly worked with various Adivasi communities, Peel and Gan communities in particular, who, are really large heterogeneous communities. Millions and millions of people we're talking about, like over 16 million people in the case of the Beals. And I've obviously not worked with 16 million people. I've worked with some slim, sample of that. And mostly amongst communities that are facing conservation and development-induced displacement or who have already been moved into resettlement, because that's where a lot of the language of endangerment these days, a lot of endangerment discourse from the media and from activists is focusing. And so what I've found is that most, you can call them sort of average Adivasis who are being displaced or considering moving out of their forest homes or have already moved from their former forest homes, don't typically amongst themselves, I'm trying to be careful here, frame their experience as, what I call this meta-narrative of endangerment discourse, this major overarching view of cultural loss and decline, and that they themselves and their communities are going extinct. They have a lot of problems. There's a lot of struggles, like everyone in the world. I mean, the world has struggles, and the Buddha said life is suffering, but they have more than most, certainly. I could probably say more than you or I. And they talk a lot about their problems and about their issues, but it's not usually the case that they will then come out and just like make big broad statements like, oh, my culture is disappearing. My community is becoming extinct. But they will make those statements if there's a major activist campaign involved with them that, pushes them to kind of describe their issues that way. They will make the statements if you ask them loaded questions, point blank, is that happening to you? Sometimes they won't. Sometimes they'll say, no, my culture is strong. My traditions are strong. What are you talking about? And there's a diversity of answers. And I would say just because people don't necessarily describe their own tradition in that terms just amongst themselves or on a daily basis, that doesn't mean the issue is not there either. But it it isn't primarily the way that I've found that communities self-identify. You know, actually, just to say one more word about that, communities themselves, amongst themselves, when they're talking to each other on a daily basis, BL communities, let's say, they don't refer to themselves as Adivasi either, necessarily. They refer to themselves as Basava, as Tarviyavspaura, et cetera, as their various local community names, and they differentiate themselves, you know, that way from one another. And so there's a lot of these outside discourses, they're big, you know, everybody kind of wants to be able to understand, like, in a quick and simple way, what other communities are about. And from, you know, the outside world, they're Adivasis. From the outside world, they're endangered Adivasis very often. And, you know, that's true, whether it's people coming from, you know, urban backgrounds, middle-class backgrounds in India, or, you know, Western global activists. You know, on the ground, the situation is a little bit more complex than that. And people have pretty, I would say, more nuanced perspectives. And, you know, there's and there is a lot of pride in tradition and a lot of feelings also that, you know, they're keeping their traditions alive. And yeah, things are changing, but that doesn't mean that, you know, actually, I've lived in the Gulf as well, in Abu Dhabi for some years. And, you know, in the Gulf, people are very proud of their tribal heritage and tradition, but they're also driving, you know, Lamborghinis and Maseratis and building huge skyscrapers. And so they don't think that their religion and their culture is extinct. There's a lot of questions about it and about what, like, all this modernity and cultural change means for them. But every community has, you know, experiences change. Woody Allen once joked, you know, change equals death. Oh, I hate change. You know, understand the nature of social change in these communities is really different from just a simple declaration that they are in danger of extinction.
Yeah, one of the key points and takeaways, I think is transferable to a number of projects and subfields and even disciplines, is that the discourse of the other and of the margins are very different when you're in the very margins themselves, where actually there's a centrality of the narrative. This is where we are. This is the center of our world. This is how we see our world. We're not perceiving ourselves from the margins. So there's that toggling between, you know, othering and marginalization of others versus a self-identification or a self-adjudication or a self-expression, which isn't sidestepping issues. It's framing it in a different way. And the other point that comes to me time and time again is, you know, as we're talking now, but even as I was looking at your chapters, is one of the fundamental distinctions is a narrative that's empowering versus a narrative that's disempowering. Mm-hmm. A narrative of people who need to be saved, rescued, helped, a narrative that's imbued with some level of condescension, even pity, even, you know, they need us to rescue them. And it's somewhat egotistical in a sense, versus a narrative of empowerment where I own my agency, you know, I own my circumstance. There are some real threats to our survival and questions, but I'm not disempowered. I don't have that narrative of needing to be saved. And that's one of the points that kind of comes to me as you're talking that I find fascinating.
You know, absolutely. I really appreciate that. That's really deep, actually. You know, at first when you started talking, I was just going to make some sort of almost a glib joke that back in the day, I wanted to start a center for peripheral studies.
Isn't that religious studies? Then never mind. Go on.
All the humanities and social studies sciences are these days, my friend, unfortunately. You know, there's all this discourse of the humanities and social sciences being endangered as well. But us, you know, poor marginalized academics. More seriously, I think you're absolutely right. It's about trying to understand people's agency and their own perspective and their, you know, the celebrations of their own culture, and pride in their own culture. At the same time, you know, recognizing these issues of precarity and everything. But I guess the issue is sort of one of self-determination, right? If Adivasi communities choose to explicitly recognize themselves as endangered and want to represent themselves that way, to the outside world, if not necessarily always to themselves, and use that in their struggle, struggles to improve their lot in life and their communities and their cultures, you know, more power to them. I think the problem really has come though, because it's been the, you know, people with a kind of a white savior complex, or, you know, missionaries who think that they were going to save the tribes by saving their souls, who came in with these notions of vanishing Indians, vanishing, you know, the other vanishing Indian, and all sorts of stereotypes about these communities, who they were going to uplift or reform or save in various, you know, ways that were often deeply problematic, that I'm trying to address first and foremost, and you know, trying to situate that vis-a-vis these communities, at least what I can gain, have been able to gain from these communities, you know, impressions of those narratives and also of their own experience.
Fascinating. Now, let's close with this question. Do you, is this work that you are or hope to continue in some way? What's sort of next for you?
It's a great question. I love this kind of work. It's been, you know, my life work for many years now. I think that specifically the concept or nature of endangerment I've worked with enough. I found recently some really fascinating archival material on the first national park ever in Africa, in the Belgian Congo, actually, where in the 1920s, there was this whole slew of, actually, frankly, American eugenicists who went and said that we are going to, you know, try to save not only the gorillas, but the pygmies who are threatened with extinction. And I had this idea of maybe doing a kind of an global edited volume about national parks and other protected areas that were specifically formed for the purposes of protecting indigenous cultures. And there was one famous case in Brazil. There's a case there in Indonesia. There's this whole history of a man named Paul Sarazan, an anthropologisches Naturschutz, the idea of anthropological nature protection that was coming out of the early 20th century, and the idea of creating nature reserves for indigenous peoples. And in fact, the first ever call for a national park in the US context by a man named George Catlin called for the creation of a park where they could preserve man and beast, Indians galloping on horseback in their native attire amidst the fleeting herd of bison was the good paraphrase of the quote. basically collecting those histories of this problematic attempt to preserve indigenous cultures, specifically in national parks around the world. I think that might be something I'd like to pursue. So if anybody listening to this has a paper on one of those kinds of parks in particular, you could please consider reaching out to me.
Excellent. I really appreciate that call to action to the audience. Every once in a while, sort of slip in, you know, so any grad students, this is an area, you know, whether it's manuscriptology or whatever, you know, but no, this is, that's a great.
Plugging the new book, but plugging the even newer one that may.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great invitation, an invitation to contact you for discourse on interests and scholarly interests, etc.
Absolutely, yeah. Be
more serious. Yeah, so of course your profile is always linked. Profiles are always linked to the New Books Network site, so that'll be great. So feel free to contact Dr. Ezra Rashko for anything related to the topic. Thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Oh, thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
Fantastic speaking with you, and we really do have to have a conversation more than every 5 years or so. For those of you listening, we've been speaking about a brand new OUP book called The Nature of Endangerment in India. Until next time, keep well, keep safe, keep listening, and keep contemplating narratives of the center and the periphery, and maybe how they cross-pollinate. Take care.